Is this working?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome to the First Unitarian Church of Alton. My name is Yomi Kinder. Welcome to this place. This is a home where no revealed truths are promoted and no scripture or human being accepted as infallible. This is a place for searching and for truth. But we are believers. We believe in intellectual freedom. We believe in justice. We believe in compassion and concern for each other and the whole world. We believe in commitment to those ideals which make us caring and active in the struggles for human dignity. We are Unitarian Universalists. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular to those who are first-time visitors. We welcome you and especially encourage you to join us after worship for coffee and conversation. Information about the church is available from the new members' desk and the pamphlet wall in the Kate Worker Room through those doors. We invite you to fill out one of the visitor cards in the back of the gray hymnal and place it in the offering plate or give it to an usher. We'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about the programs and activities going on at the church. We are glad you are here and hope to see you on future Sundays. If you have children with you, they are invited to attend our religious education program when the children leave for classes later on in the service. We do have a professionally staffed nursery for infants and young children. Adults are encouraged to attend the adult religious education programs each week at 11:50 a.m. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. We have one announcement. The annual congressional meeting, meeting is May 17th after the first service in the sanctuary. Please come. Today we welcome back Reverend Rebecca Turner to our pulpit. Reverend Turner is the Executive Director of Faith Aloud. She is a minister in both the United Church of Christ and the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. Last year she was named first resident theologian in reproductive justice at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. In recent years, she has been named one of the 13 religious women to watch changing the world for good by the Center for American Progress, Person of the Year by the Abortion Care Network, and Outstanding Contributor to the Advance Women's Equality by the Missouri Women's Network. Please welcome her. Our service begins with a prelude. Today's call to worship is from a clap card written by Chuck Lowry. Probably know Chuck Lowry from his many TV shows, the most recent one being The Big Bang Theory. And he likes to write these clap cards, and they flash on the screen when you watch them on TV. But I was watching his show on disc, and I was able to stop it and read one. And it was very profound, so I thought I would share it. I've been told that if you change your mind, you change the world, or at least the way we experience it. The presumption is, if you thought the world was a hostile, ugly place filled with awful people doing awful things, that's what you'd see. Your mind would naturally seek out confirmation for its preconceived ideas. If, however, you were able to sincerely change your mind and see that we are all God in drag, that we are the conscious aspects of a perfect universe which has to create us so we can bear witness and stand in awe before its loving magnificence, then that is the soul-shaking reality you'd be greeted with each and every moment of each and every day. In other words, it is entirely our choice as to what kind of world we live in. With a simple decision, we can suffer in the darkness or play in the light. We can be angry, frightened, or enslaved, or loving, joyous, and free. I know, it's a toughie. As Cole lights our chalice this morning, please join me in reciting these words. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant. To dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Thank you, Paul. Our opening hymn today is 175, We Welcome the Web of Life.
Thank you.
our intergenerational story. Yes?
This story is called The Man Who Had No Dream by Adelaide Hole. Do we have pictures? Or no? Okay. Mr. Oliver was the richest man in town. All day long, he sat at his window and watched everyone else work hard for a living. Mr. Oliver didn't have to work. He had so much money, he could buy anything he wanted. Every evening, Mr. Oliver sat at his window and waited for people to come home from work. Tired after a busy day, the townsfolk rested and looked out at the stars and the moon and the night, but not for long. They were too yawny and drowsy and sleepy from working so hard. Soon they all went to bed and fell fast asleep. After a while, Mr. Oliver went to bed too, but he didn't fall fast asleep. He just lay tossing and turning on his fine bed. The weary workers quickly drifted off to the land of dreams. They dreamed happy dreams made of wishes and hopes. They dreamed unhappy dreams made of fears and tears. But Mr. Oliver couldn't sleep because he wasn't tired. And he couldn't dream because he had nothing to dream about. No wishes, no hopes, no fears, no tears. Night after night, he tried sleeping in different beds, each one more beautiful than the last. Night after night, he walked back and forth. Still, he couldn't sleep and he couldn't dream. He just waited for morning to come, so he could go back to his window and watch everyone else work hard for a living. One night, when Mr. Oliver was very wide awake and very much alone, he heard a noise at his window. He went to look. He found a little hurt bird. There's the bird, y'all. Okay, bird. That had fluttered and fallen on his windowsill. Poor little thing, Mr. Oliver said sadly. The city is no place for birds. He lifted the little bird very gently and carried it inside. He put it to bed on a silk cushion. He fed it milk from a silver spoon. Carefully, he bandaged the hurt wing. Mr. Oliver worked and worked, at last tired and yawny and drowsy and sleepy. He fell asleep with the little bird in his arms. And while Mr. Oliver slept, something quite wonderful happened. Mr. Oliver began to dream. He dreamed there was a place in the city meant just for birds. He dreamed about a park for birds, with flowers and bird bath and trees. And the next morning, bright and early, Mr. Oliver hurried outdoors, and for the first time in his life, he began to work. He spaded and raked and planted and watered. He built a beautiful park, all planted with leafy trees and bright flowers. People and laughing children came there to romp and play and picnic on the grassy hills. From that day on, Mr. Oliver never had trouble going to sleep, and he never slept without a dream. Mr. Oliver was a happy, busy man, a man with wishes and hopes and fears and tears.
Okay.
Rejoice in love, we know and share.
invite you to move to the microphone and share briefly any gratitudes or celebrations you bring to church to you this morning. There will be time for sorrows and concerns in a few minutes. Anybody? Okay. I invite you to move to the microphone and share briefly any sorrows or concerns you bring with you. Okay. Our meditation today is a visualization, so if you could play along. I would like you to envision a ball of light at your abdomen. And into that ball of light, put all your worries and your anxieties and your peccadilloes and form it into a nice tight ball. Now envision that ball being pushed down through the floor and through the foundation and back into the earth where it can be recycled into new and wondrous things. Don't worry, they'll all grow back. May these gratitudes and celebrations among us this day become a blessing to all, and may the concerns and sorrows of each, spoken and unspoken, be carried in our hearts. A burden shared becomes a load lightened. Okay, and our meditation song is number 88, Calm Soul of All Things. Receive from this church the opportunity to explore meaning, purpose, and value in our lives. How does the money you give reflect what you receive? As you give to our plate this morning, you are invited to consider how your spiritual life, that life of meaning and value and purpose, are enhanced through your giving. This morning's offering will be gratefully received, maybe joyfully given. Thank you. Please join me in reciting the offering blessing. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves and these are our offerings. Now it's Reverend Turner's turn.
Thank you, Yomi. It's a pleasure being back here. It's been quite a few years. If I don't look familiar to you, that's okay. I've probably changed in the years that have gone by. But it is always delightful to make a repeat visit to a congregation. And it's always a delight to come to Alton, just to drive through the streets and enjoy the architecture. And it's just such a special little town. So I've been executive director of Faith Aloud for about 14 years now. It was 2001. And Faith Aloud is a reproductive justice organization. And so I decided to, for a reading, to read from a brand new book, really just published like a week ago, but written by a friend of mine in St. Louis. Her name is Pat Piety. I encourage you, if you like, if you're intrigued by what you hear, to look it up on Amazon and grab it. It's called Don't Get Yourself Talked About. And the very first page begins like this. I thought I would never forget anything about that room. As I lay on the bed that night before my 15th birthday, I surveyed it like an archaeologist, carefully noting everything, the perfectly smooth white woodwork and the shoulder-high windows that wrapped around the corner, covered by heavy drapes. But now I'm no longer sure about all the details, whether the walls were mint green or beige, or the woodwork included fancy scrolled corners or plain miter joints. It was a very long time ago. Until a few days before, I had thought I loved Ronnie. Now I wasn't thinking at all, even though I was carrying his baby. On our way to Piggott, Arkansas, in his secondhand Pontiac, Ronnie had given me a wedding ring with a tiny chip diamond in it. We had heard there was no waiting period there and that girls didn't have to be over 16 to get married without their parents' consent. I was prepared to lie about my age, but when we arrived, we found the rules had changed. There was a waiting period and blood test, and you needed a birth certificate. I had no idea where my birth certificate was, and we couldn't afford to stay in a motel 3 days. Anyway, I knew that within a few hours, my parents would have the highway patrol after us. So we turned around and drove home through the night, stopping to make love in the car in Olive Branch, Illinois, not speaking about what was awaiting at home. It was 1954, and my parents were co-pastors of a tiny Assemblies of God church in East St. Louis, Illinois, a church that didn't believe in sex before marriage or divorce afterwards, and certainly not abortion at any time. Anyway, abortion was still illegal in the United States. If anyone ever found out what Mom and Dad were doing, they would not only lose their church, they would lose their licenses as ministers, and they would probably go to jail. They didn't have to tell me, I just knew. I'm so proud to know Pat. That is the perfect introduction to the work of Faith Aloud. The ways that religion and reproductive rights have always bumped up against each other and often been uncomfortable with one another and have challenged one another, and yet we know that what happens in secret is very different from the public understanding of religion and reproductive health. And so now I'm going to move very quickly into the present. What I want to give you today is a look at the landscape of reproductive rights. You know, here, just across the river from me, You are much more protected in Illinois. Women's reproductive rights are much more protected than back in my home in Missouri. But the political and cultural landscape for reproductive rights is constantly changing, and it changes rapidly. There are a lot of factors that come together at particular moments to create trends. And so I'm going to share the trends that seem to fill my inbox the most recently. And because a lot of those are really depressing, I don't want us to go away totally depressed today, I want to also add on some trends that I find that give me hope. So, but I'm going to start with the scary stuff, okay? And I suppose I should say, you know, I'm always incredibly indebted and grateful to Unitarians for understanding freedom and justice on a really personal level, and for being there as an entire denomination and as individual congregations to support women at the times that they need it most. Scary trends. Trend number one is the most prevalent trend, I believe, and not just very recently, but over the past decade or more. And that trend is TRAP laws. Now, TRAP stands for Targeted Restrictions on Abortion Providers. Okay, and so TRAP laws are any laws that actually impact and restrict the way an abortion clinic or a doctor can function. So the big trend over the past, as I said, over the past decade or so, has been to make the laws that do restrictions not be on women themselves, but on the providers. And these have been begun by the thousands all around the country in state legislatures. The idea behind them is to make it too difficult for clinics to stay in business. And clinics have closed in nearly every state in the union because of TRAP laws. The laws include things about the physical aspect of the building, such as how wide the hallways need to be in the building. Or even in Virginia, there was a law that was upheld that forced clinics to change the direction of the airflow in their HVAC systems. So the venting all had to be reworked to go the opposite direction. Now, in no way does that improve women's health, and yet that's what they said had to be done. Clinics have spent millions redesigning their structures, only to have the legislatures then, a couple of years later, change the law to something else, so that they would either have to change it all back, or they would have to change something else fit, you know, structurally within the physical nature of their buildings. Laws also include things like whether a doctor can come from out of state, and there are quite a few. Missouri is one of those. If a doctor doesn't have, you know, privileges at a hospital within a very few, limited number of miles from where abortions are being provided, then they aren't allowed to provide services there at all. Some states absolutely depend upon a doctor flying in from another area because they are such a rural state, like North Dakota. And the hospital privileges requirement is especially sticky because there are now a lot of smaller cities throughout the U.S. where the only hospital is a Catholic hospital, and therefore will never agree to give privileges to doctors who provide abortions, even if they limit those to those who will protect the life of the mother. In Missouri, North Dakota, and Mississippi, there is only one facility left in the entire state that is providing abortions. In Texas, in 2011, there were 44 facilities throughout that gigantic state. Today, there are just 20. And all of those closures were due to TRAP laws passed by the Texas legislature. Abortion may still be technically legal in all of these places, But if women have to travel hundreds of miles in order to get to a legitimate, safe provider, then it may as well be illegal. And we know that there's many cases where women have chosen to order medicines off of the internet, not knowing where they're coming from, if they're getting the right drugs, not knowing how to take them properly, and to self-induce because they could not get those hundreds, they couldn't take off work, they couldn't travel those hundreds of miles. Trend number two, have you heard of this one? This is pretty new. Abortion reversal. Yeah. Yeah, this is seriously disturbing. For years, many states, my state of Missouri included, has required clinics to lie to women about a number of things before they have an abortion. But this one really beats all. This year in Arizona and Arkansas, it is now the law for clinics to inform women that abortion can be reversed. And thank you. No, don't shush him. Yes, I like that response.
Yes,
exactly. So, but this notion is based upon the idea that a woman who has taken the first round of drugs for abortion could then go to a different clinic and get a different set of drugs, a bunch of hormones, that will instantly reverse those drugs that she's just taken before the abortion fully begins to happen. There is zero science to back this up, and yet these little abortion reversal clinics are springing up in a lot of places. These quacks who give this reversal treatment can always just say, oh, I'm sorry you didn't get here soon enough. Can you imagine the increased trauma to women? Can you even imagine? And of course, she's putting her health at risk. I like him. We'll have talk back after this, okay? Great question. States are buying into this. Even though, you know, these are the same states that will say that, okay, you know, doctors can't use abortion drugs at all because they're using them slightly off-label, because they've learned more effective ways to use them than what the original, you know, FDA label says. And they're saying, no, now you can't do that. You can only use it on label. And they're saying, well, actually, that's bad for women's health. You know, that's not as safe for us to do that. And so, so in some places, abortion drugs are being completely outlawed, claiming that, you know, you have to do it on label, and, you know, citing so-called scientific reasons. And then these same states will buy into this abortion reversal stuff and allow women to be submitted to this medical treatment that has no science whatsoever, and to be given some sort of drugs that are completely off-label. So, you know, it's just, the philosophy is the end justifies the means, right? Trend number three, religious exemptions. So last year, you know, the Supreme Court dealt a devastating blow to women and to religious freedom and to the Affordable Care Act by granting employers in for-profit corporations the right to use their own private religion as an excuse to deny basic insurance for contraception. The court has opened Pandora's box. Of course, this began really when the court declared that corporations are people with individual rights, and well, if they're people, then I guess they might as well be religious people whose religious freedom needs protecting from the likes of employees who want to use contraception. Okay, I didn't follow that very well either. But that's what the Supreme Court has said. This trend, I think, frightens me the most because it turns upside down our American value of the freedom of religion as an ideology that protects individuals from religious discrimination by those in power. It's really turned that upside down, and now it's the ones in power who can use their religion to discriminate against their employees. It's not just about contraception. In Tennessee and several other states, in some school districts, efforts are being to pass laws against bullying have been tarnished with amendments that provide religious exemption. So as long as you say you're a good religious person, you can bully somebody else all you want to. Seriously disturbing. Only days after the Hobby Lobby decision, a coalition of Catholic and evangelical fundamentalist leaders sent President Obama a letter requesting religious exemption from all non-discrimination laws. Now, one might argue that if they work for exclusive religious institutions, they could make whatever rules they want. But these leaders represent institutions that receive federal money. They want to dip from both sides. The president did not cave on this one, but lawsuits are still pending. Trend number four, and I sort of alluded to this already, the idea of protection for women, which frankly is kind of a very patriarchal, ooh, women need protection, we have to save them from themselves attitude. But it sounds better to say, oh, we're protecting women's health. And you know, because the whole stop killing babies thing, PR-wise, just didn't really work out that well for an anti-choice movement. It was negative, it sounded a little hysterical, and for the most part, the majority of people really do believe that women needed to be able to protect themselves from pregnancies that were not conceived in love or those that were medically dangerous. So the think tanks decided that protecting women would be the right strategy for making abortion inaccessible. Whenever you hear an argument now in our state that begs for more trap laws, it's with the excuse that women must be protected from the evil, money-grabbing abortionist. They insist that it's all about making abortion safer when in fact the new restrictions make it far more dangerous by forcing women to travel hundreds of miles to get to a provider, or to seek assistance from unknown sources. They like to talk about restrictions on contraception in a medical way, reading all of the cautions on the pill pack to emphasize the dangerous reactions a woman might have to the drug, and inflating the number of women who actually have any reaction at all. Some anti-choice groups have even adopted the word feminist, insisting that what's good for women is to have all the babies that they can. Trend number five, happening in my state right now, getting a man's permission. Back in the 60s, it was very common for a pharmacist to require a husband's signature for a woman to be able to get contraceptive pills. And now we're seeing a serious attack on reproductive freedom in the name of men's rights. In Missouri, a bill is under discussion that would require the man's permission before a woman could undergo an abortion. Now, I know and I have some sympathy for men who want very much to be involved in decision making, about their about any children that they might have. I've got sympathy for that. Lots of progressives say, well, a man ought to have a say in the matter. I'm all for good communication between partners. And I really hope that the man is in such good communication with the woman that he's going to be fully supportive in whatever support she needs for whatever decision she makes. But should anyone of any gender have the final say over something that happens to your body? Should you give that away to anybody else? I say no, quite simply. Our bodies are our most personal, private, precious assets. Nobody gets veto power over my decisions about what happens inside of me. And, if we were to look at it in another way, whenever a man actually wants to control what a woman does, we call that abuse. And abuse is never a man's right over a woman. Controlling somebody else's body is abusive. Okay, 5 really bad trends. That stuff is depressing. Those things are gaining a lot of speed, but I want to turn this around and give us some hope and some strategy. Trend number 6 is reproductive justice. I want you to know that that's not just the latest words, like first it was abortion rights and then it was reproductive choice and now it's reproductive justice. It's not a way to disguise what we're talking about. It's not just the latest in word. An African-American woman named Loretta Ross began an organization called Sister Song a couple of decades ago, and she coined the term reproductive justice. Reproductive justice is a call for justice by millions of women of color who have been the victims of government intrusion into their reproductive lives by deeming them to be unfit mothers, by doing forced sterilizations, by imprisoning them for doing their own abortions when they could not afford to see a doctor, by making it hard for them to get contraception. Reproductive justice recognizes that there are a host of social ills that make it difficult for women to decide if and when to have children and to even parent their children well. Poverty, racism, violence, poor schools, lack of health cares. These are the very real things that limit women's choices. It's not just whether or not they can get to the right doctor. So reproductive justice is the voice of a whole new generation of activists that understand the inextricable connections between justice issues. And they give me hope. Trend number 7, progressive religious voices, like Unitarians, like the UCC, and like a lot of other more progressive denominations that are beginning to speak out in some new ways. I am seeing more progressive clergy take a stand, especially in regards to healthcare and economic justice. I'm seeing clergy who are connecting the dots between social justice issues and leading their congregations to become more engaged publicly. I'm seeing large evangelical groups actually begin to take more progressive stands on some issues. Not necessarily on women's issues just yet, but certainly on things like the environment and LGBT issues. Some groups that were really, really fundamentalist are now on board with those. And there's the Pope. Hey, what about this Pope? While not taking a strong stand, you know, specifically for women, what we do hear him doing is opposition to extremist positions, making a priority of compassion over judgmental religion. And that's a giant leap in the right direction. What he has said is, we got to, you know, all these bishops who are obsessing about abortion and LGBT issues, he actually demoted them. They don't have the voice of power anymore. They are not, they are not the ones who are making church law for the Catholic Church now. So big changes there. I'm also, it also gives me hope because I'm seeing more grant money that is interested in supporting progressive religious voices so that they can make a louder noise. Progressive grant makers used to just avoid religion like the plague. They didn't want to support religious groups. But now they're understanding that making social justice versus religion doesn't work. And there are lots and lots of progressive religious voices like ours who want to be there making a difference. They're seeing the opportunities for change. Trend number 8. The Rising American Electorate, or the RAE. According to the Voter Participation Center in Washington, D.C., in 2010, more than 71 million unmarried women, people of color, and people under 30, the groups that make up the Rising American Electorate, and the majority of voting eligible members in American democracy, did not vote. The majority of voting eligible people did not vote. 71 million unmarried women, people of color, and people under 30. Nearly two-thirds of them, 46 million, were not registered, 25 million were registered but did not vote. In 2008, more than 46 million Rising American Electorate members failed to vote. Of those non-voters, 37 million were not registered compared to the 9 million who were. Now, we could just decry, oh, people just don't care about voting, or we could say this is an opportunity. What happens if we get these people registered? What do we know about unmarried women, people of color, and people under 30? That when they vote overwhelmingly for progressive values. This is even true for Latinos, who are often assumed to be conservative Catholics. Really not true. Polling in states with large Latino populations show that assumption to be wrong. Turns out that Latinos are far more likely to vote their own interest than to vote by, you know, what the church says. The solution to this problem of lack of voting is not terribly complex, but it does require some hard work. Massive voter registration, GOTV efforts with these populations could significantly change the outcome of elections in the majority of states. Trend number 9, progressive youth attitudes. Recent study on millennials released by the Reason Foundation, which is a libertarian group, says that today's young adults are social liberals. This generation is racially diverse. Right now, 44% are non-white. They are pro-legalized marijuana, pro-marriage equality. 74% of millennials want the government to guarantee food, housing, and health insurance to every American. A very progressive notion. 58% want the government to spend more on the poor. The discouraging part of the studies for older activists like me is that millennials as a whole seem to show less interest in activism because they don't like fighting. Well, we could sympathize with that, right? What does interest them is throwing a party where everybody is welcome. Sort of the Unitarian spirit, right? So if we're smart, we can use that mentality of younger adults to turn young adults away from the narrow-minded, exclusionary tactics of the right and toward a more inclusive rendition of freedom that applies to everyone. Trend 10, the last one, cultural attitudes toward LGBT persons. This very weekend, is designated National Weekend of Prayer for Marriage Equality. And the reason it's been designated as such is because the Supreme Court this week is hearing more marriage equality cases. It is quite possible that the decisions that come out of this week's hearings will be less narrow than the previous ones, more sweeping, quite possibly bringing marriage equality to the entire nation. Cultural attitudes toward the many varieties of intimate relationships have shifted dramatically in the past few years. We have passed that tipping point, and it is clear that marriage equality will someday soon be the law of the land. Now, we all celebrate this, but why do I mention it as a positive for reproductive rights? Well, on the most simple level, when values become more progressive in one arena, it does support them in other areas. But it's more than that. It's because the issues of reproductive rights and LGBT rights can never really be separated, because at the very heart of both is the cultural attitude toward gender and gender roles. When we embrace a more egalitarian attitude for differing gender expressions, that includes women's equality. If we say it doesn't matter who has sex with whom within an adult, respectful relationship, then the culture of misogyny and rape diminishes. So to summarize, it's no coincidence that these negative trends and the positive trends are sort of balancing one another. They reflect one another and overlap. We see a lot of clashing going on between those who are determined to outlaw all abortion and those who are working for a more just society. I encourage you to get involved in whatever ways you can. So where can you make the biggest impact? I would say the biggest impact would be by working with organizations that are talking to new people, not talking to the same old activist over and over again, but talking to new people, especially those in the rising American electorate. You can help register people to vote, get them to the polls. You can make sure that your local school district is offering medically accurate sexual health education. You can ask at your pharmacies and see if they're carrying emergency contraception over the counter, which they are supposed to be doing. You can work across the lines of various justice causes to build commonality and understanding between the issues. If your particular issue is racial justice, be there and talk about how women are and their parenting is impacted by racial justice issues. It's all connected. Together, we can make a better world that respects all people and all of their choices. Thank you.
Our last hymn today is 124, Be That Guide.
To mention that I brought some materials from Faith Aloud that are on the table, and please pick up and take whatever you can use, and I'll probably leave all of them here for the church. Let compassion turn us to justice, and justice turn us to action. May we individually and collectively be the change we wish to see in the world. Amen.